Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas Podcast. Today, my very special guest is Father David McCallum. David is a friend and a colleague. We've worked together for a few years. David's a Jesuit priest from the USA, and he now serves as a founding executive director of the Program for Discerning Leadership, which is a special initiative of the Society of Jesus headquartered in Rome. This program provides leadership formation and organizational development to support senior Vatican officials and major superiors of religious orders headquartered in Rome and internationally. From 21 to 24, Father McCallum has worked with the Secretariat of the Synod of Bishops, and formerly he served as Dean of the Madden School of Business at Le Moyne College in Syracuse, New York State. His doctoral research was focused on leadership, on conflict, complexity, and ambiguity. And working with David, this is his views on systems and complexity are really important, and the Catholic Church needs these views very much at the moment. David, you're welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you today?
I'm good, Simon. It's such a pleasure to be with you, and I feel very privileged, actually, to be joining your podcast. I've been listening to it for years and have benefited so much from the wisdom you and your participants, you know, generate in your conversation. So thanks so much.
Thank you. So just to let the listeners know, I've been working alongside David. He invited me to observe and become part of the community, really with the focus on the synod, the idea Pope Francis had of synodality being central to the church. And today we'd like to talk about that and talk about Pope Francis. I contacted David after Pope Francis had passed away because Pope Francis had a huge impression on me. He left me very moved, just his being and his presence. So that's what we're going to talk about today. Did you ever meet Pope Francis, David?
No, I would say about 5-6 times we had brief interactions. And I would say, you know, my experience of him was as a grandfather of many, many, many children and grandchildren whom he wanted to spend equal time with and really be present with. But ultimately, that time was always very limited. So they were interactions that were very personal, very often very playful and humorous. Mm-hmm. He had a great gift for spontaneity, and I think his greatest joy was actually having just regular encounters with regular people, not the formalities of his role. About 5-6 times.
Yeah. Now that really comes across his just pleasure, really deep joy of being with people. Just it really shone. His eyes lit up.
In fact, Simon, as he was recovering from his hospitalization over the last few months. It was the experience of sneaking into St. Peter's Basilica from his sick bed against the will of his doctors that seemed to give him life again. And it was because of that that I think they made some accommodations to allow him to also go out to the square to address the crowds at Easter. And in fact, if I'm not mistaken, his last words were actually to his nurse, who said, thank you for bringing me back to the square, which is really where he had those wonderful encounters with people in St. Peter's Basilica, that beautiful encircling square in front of the basilica.
Yeah. And one thing really interested me about Pope Francis was how he seemed to understand very, very deeply the importance of the symbolic. When you look at the Catholic Church, you look at the hierarchies, the structures, you know, the embedded ways of being, change is quite difficult. You know, there's a lot of pressures, a lot of tensions. So to try and change the structures is problematic. But Francis seemed to intuitively know that actually change takes place in a different way, at the edges, as we say. Do you want to say something about that?
Sure. You know, one thing that he had an incredibly astute awareness of is that change in the church wouldn't come from the center, that it would come from the peripheries. And so because the center is so bureaucratic and so tightly controlled, so formal, he went and brought the peripheries to the center. So for instance, in the Amazonian Synod, instead of having an experience going there and working within the Amazonian context, those participants were brought to Rome. And in fact, it created quite a disorienting dilemma for many of the religious and the clergy here in Rome, who weren't accustomed to this sort of syncretism between the Amazonian Indian customs and the expressions of Catholicity and Catholicism as we know them from Western European perspectives. But this is actually what generated so much life and creativity and I think really enhanced a more global perspective and understanding. So his capacity to go to the peripheries, his concern that the synod process also not just go back to the folks in the pews who are, you know, the most predictable voices, but really the people who feel ostracized from the church, those who felt in any way alienated because of church teachings or because of socioeconomic status or cultural exclusions. Symbolically too, you know, he knew that the gestures, for instance, of wearing his old black shoes, yeah, of lowering the seat actually on which he sat in formal meetings down to the floor level instead of on a raised dais, moving to Casa Santa Marta out of the apostolic apartments. I mean, there's just one thing after another. Another, if you recall, a very iconic moment was during COVID, and he wanted to address the real intense experience of anxiety, of loss, and of uncertainty that so many people around the world were experiencing during the pandemic. And so one night in the rain, he ascends the steps in St. Peter's Square and alone addresses the public. And there, you know, with the cross, I think really spoke to people in a very profound way. In a way, I think that, you know, transcends religious traditions or denominations. It really spoke at a human level to the level of loneliness that so many people were feeling in isolation. So, yeah, I think you're spot on. The sense of a symbolic attention to the power of these gestures and the way in which, at a very subtle level, they could transmit the sense that business is being conducted in a different way, that there's a different culture and a different set of priorities in play.
Yeah. No, I think his leadership, I think many can learn from his leadership. There's the powerful impact he had on people's lives. But leaders studying what he did, I think bringing, we talk in the Eco Leadership Institute of leading from the edge, you know, leadership from the edge, is precisely what he did, bringing those leaders in from the periphery to the center. The idea of symbolic leadership around, it's very much how you show up, how you communicate, your small actions, very, very powerful. For leaders, and often overlooked. You know, they're so busy with their strategies and their PowerPoints and making their speeches that they forget these very subtle but very, very powerful kind of ways of being. Can you say something, I mean, for the audience, about synodality? Because for me, again, this is very, very interesting, because it was symbolic but also structural. It was changing something. Can you speak to that?
Yeah. So one of the things that Francis was acutely aware of in his pastoral work in Argentina and also within the Bishops' Conference of South America is that the gap, or any gap, between clergy and the rest of the people of God, of whom the clergy are a part, when that gap grows because of what's often known as clericalism, mm-hmm. the sense of a priest being elevated onto a pedestal, and then the people, in a sense, being in a dependent role, that that this undermined this sense in which everybody is a protagonist for the mission of the church. He was also very aware that it's so easy within social systems that those who are part of any hierarchy are going to identify with people who are part of the other hierarchies. So that means that the church so easily can get conscripted to serving the interests of the rich and the powerful. But Francis had this very, I think, experiential wisdom around listening to the poor, accompanying people who are, in the case of Argentina, living in very impoverished communities and yet very cohesive communities, and understanding that there is a wisdom and a simplicity in the way people lived that shouldn't be overlooked, that the way in which they transmitted their faith and often very pious and simple customs was powerful and worthy of, respect. I'm so sorry about that. So those experiences in South America really, I think, attuned him to the importance of listening to the people and not only paying attention to those who are already part of an established, authority framework. And that was one thing. Another thing, Simon, which I think is very personal to him, Pope Francis, when he was a novice master, when he was provincial of the Jesuits in Argentina during the Dirty War, when he was responsible for the diocese, it was clear that he was learning by experience his own tendency, because of personality, to be a bit autocratic. Mm-hmm. He understood based on how the style in which he exercised authority generated a polarized kind of public and was divisive. And he had time to really reflect on this style and the negative impact that it had. And so it was both the positive experience of listening to the people and this kind of negative experience, if you will, and of learning by experience how not to exercise power, that for him led him, as he entered into the papacy, to really prioritize a pathway of reformation and regeneration in the church. And it wasn't only a progressive project, like many conservatives thought. In fact, it actually was going back to the roots of the earliest Christian community who tended to gather and make decisions in a much more communal way. Mm-hmm. With prayer, listening to diverse voices, working to build consensus. In fact, that experience in the first century of the church is recorded in the Acts of the Apostles as the Council in Jerusalem. And there's a way in which that experience, it planted a sort of seed that was the church's way of proceeding for about 6 or 7 centuries, more or less, even amidst, the rise of an imperial style of church. Mm. All these centuries later, Francis really sees that this path of returning to these circular processes of listening and of discerning and building consensus is really what the world needs today. Mm-hmm. And that it was going to help us do two things within the Catholic Church. One, it would be a way of honoring the equal dignity of every human person and enhancing their participation in even a hierarchical structure. So not canceling hierarchy, not canceling out, top-down authority, but balancing it with appropriate levels of participation and consensus building, right? So that was one part of the kind of focus. The other is to really attend to building harmony and unity, but without really dampening our incredible diversity. Mm-hmm. The church is incredibly diverse culturally. So it's able to, in a sense, attend to these two massive and very timely topics and do it in an experiential way. There's a lot more I could say on this, but let me get you in here.
Yeah. I mean, the for the listeners, I'm not a Catholic, just to let people know. So I came with a naive lens, you know, it's not my tradition. So a lot of things were new to me. But the synod traditionally was a synod of bishops, of male bishops, and they their role was to support the Pope in decision making. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And what Francis did was to bring in women, lay people, people from the religious orders, and these are many of the people I met. So these what David did was set up an accompaniment group of 50 or 60 people, and they were spiritual directors, people who had coach training, people who were counselors, to support leaders. And working with them and seeing the impact of synodality was very moving. I mean, it was just a very moving experience to see what participation, what being invited does to people. I mean, simply being at the table. And I think you said, David, that David attended these synods, and at each table there was, who was at the table? Who would be at each round table?
Wow. So we were actually segmented by language group, but even at an English speaking table, for instance, you had a patriarch from the Middle East. You had cardinals and archbishops from parts of the world that are maybe English speaking or English as a second or third language, but that was convenient for people. There might be a laywoman from Papua New Guinea or from the Philippines who's a catechist and works in her local church. There might have been the superior of a religious order headquartered here in Rome, but from a very different context. So the eight of us, women and men, clergy, religious and lay, intergenerational, including young people in college who were sitting at the table with people who would be considered some of the most senior theologians in the church. Yeah, we were diverse.
And, you know, that is such a radical change from a group of powerful men who've reached bishop status supporting decision making. You know, it's radical. It's a real radical step. And I don't think people appreciate how radical Pope Francis was in the way he took up role. And like you say, it wasn't some radical progressive agenda. It was actually a return to the early church. And I think that's important.
Well, it's funny. I mean, I would just play with your words a little bit, because some people didn't recognize how radical he was, and some didn't appreciate how radical he was. So there's a way in which, you know, there was, I think, to be honest with you, and this is a theological observation, that the Holy Spirit was really working through Francis and the synodal process at that particular moment in history, where we see the rise of authoritarianism around the world. We see this reversion to the circling of wagons with nationalism and populism. And here the church is doing something completely different. Mm. It's opening up the lines of communications, the channels. It's allowing a diversity of people who don't necessarily have entitlement to be at the table. You know, it's shifting from, like you say, visually from a stadium seating, all facing, you know, a kind of raised bank of speakers, all who have big hats and, you know, very colorful outfits, but all, you know, with rank, to moving to circular tables with facilitation, for that matter. Facilitation was something that had never existed in these settings before. And then a protocol, a method of being with one another that actually enhanced each person's reflection time, to have an individual voice and contribution, to be heard and listened to by each person around the table, and then to come to some kind of consensus mm-hmm. around each of these tables, around what we wanted to offer in the plenary. Very different way of proceeding. And yeah, Francis, I don't know that he envisioned exactly what it looked like, but he was definitely there and presiding and kind of along for the ride in a way that was encouraging, helping to set some boundaries and to really keep focused on moving the church forward.
Yeah. And, you know, when I go into I often spend a few minutes each day in a church, lighting a candle, saying a prayer. And my local Catholic church, on the newsletter there's somebody working on synodality. So it's not just this group who come together once every few years and meet. It's actually happening in every church and in every community, isn't it, across the globe. So it's a very much a networked kind of ecosystem approach.
Yeah. It was actually probably the most complex, comprehensive data collection process in the history of the world. and certainly imperfect, you know.
Yeah,
But you know, how could it ever be perfect? And so the fact that it happened, the fact that you know, the process of collecting input from the level of the parish that then was aggregated at the level of the diocese and then at the level of the continent. And then what was amazing is to be in the meeting where we had all these continental syntheses delivered to us with verbatim comments from individuals at the parish level. So there was fidelity, right, at each level of the process for many parts of the world. In some places there was more censorship and more massaging of the data, but to get those verbatim experiences of people in the joys and the sorrows and the longings of their experience of the Catholic Church. And then at this continental phase, we were to try to deliver another level of reflection. And what came out of our collective process, about 35 of us over the course of a few weeks working on this in a residential context, you know, praying, examining, listening, drafting, was this idea of an image from the prophet Isaiah that the church must expand the space of its tent. Mm-hmm. And that this image for us spoke so powerfully to our experience of people's desire, generally speaking, to have a church more welcoming, more inclusive, more open to its diversity, flexible and structured at the same time, like a tent is, but not so carefully bounded that people would be left outside. And you know, this is one of the critical friction points for those who want to hold on to a tradition and maintain the boundaries in a way that become barriers. And those who want to do something more flexible and inviting. And what Pope Francis was constantly leaning toward is we need to err in the direction of what Jesus in the gospel himself models, which is a church for all, a church where you don't have to be perfect, you know, to be included.
Yeah. I mean, St. Paul spoke to that as well. Neither Jew nor Gentile, neither man nor woman. It just this very, again, radical, holistic way of seeing difference, not trying to merge everything into one homogenous whole, but just allow difference to be and value it, and there will be tensions and there will be frictions, but learning to live with each other and love each other.
Yeah, and I'm not going to profess that, you know, that's an easy thing to negotiate or to facilitate. And I think the voices of those who would be more traditional, and we would maybe call them conservative, has to be heard in that sort of chorus of voices. The challenge, I think, for the executive authority is to try to harmonize those calls for boundaries and for tradition and for some kind of orthodoxy and orthopraxy, that all those things have to be heard and listened to and factored into the final discernment of how the church proceeds. As soon as they're excluded, then those positions harden. And then all of a sudden, you don't have one church anymore. So this dance, right? It's one of discernment. And I think it takes a lot of insight and flexibility, but also a lot of wisdom to do. I think Francis had a remarkable capacity. And as a Jesuit, you know, I'm certainly biased for the spirituality from which he was coming, this Ignatian spirituality. I also think we're so lucky to have Pope Leo now, who picks up the mantle from Francis, but also from Peter, right? He's the successor of Peter more than the successor of Francis. And he has this incredible capacity to be both, I would say, pastoral and very competent as an administrator, to hold the people and to hold the task, to hold the boundaries, and also to keep moving forward. This is extraordinary.
Yeah. Well, it's an extraordinary role, and to try and hold these things together and trying to do it in a way which is loving and which is hopeful in a world where hope is hard to find, I think is so important these days.
Yeah, the polarity of mercy and justice, of truth and compassion, and from our work in polarity navigation coming out of Barry Johnson's just gestalt work and the work of our friend Brian Emerson, it's really helped us, as we're supporting and facilitating the development of leaders, that these polarities are generative tensions. They have to be maintained. And even if the rest of the world, which is so polarized and so really riddled by ideology, can't maintain those both end tensions in a productive way, we've got to continue to do that. And that the church has a particular responsibility for all of its frailties and failings and sins. The church nonetheless has to continue to uphold this generative tension, the divinity and the humanity of Jesus, the way in which the sacraments are both, both bread and wine, and they are the body and the blood. These are mysteries, and they involve a kind of capacity for stretching ourselves into these both and ways of relating to the world and our own experience. That's increasingly challenging in a world that's so fraught with anxiety and fear and reactivity. And again, I think that as we're all in this work of forming leaders and forming leaders who hold spaces more than occupy places, this is the emerging capacity we're trying to develop.
Yeah, and absolutely important. Whether in the world you see, I was brought up in England and in the West, and I grew up in a very secular country. I don't know the stats, but I didn't know anybody who was religious. I didn't know anybody who went for church. No one in my school did. Well, maybe one or two, and they went quietly. But generally, like the levels of secularism, on the one hand, and then mentalism through religious, so you get these poles in society, and both are equally dangerous, I think. Both are, secularism has led us to a very strange place, and people, you can see people trying to really recover spirituality, that there's a human desire, a human need. It's kind of everywhere I go. I work in a corporate world. I work in manufacturing organizations. I work in humanitarian organizations, and you see this desire everywhere for meaning, for love, for something sacred, actually. And people trying to find a place to hang their hat and find it. But often it gets turned into a kind of narcissism, where it's turned into finding my spirituality rather than our spirituality. And again, I think that's what Pope Francis did so well. It was really show that, it's only through loving their neighbor that one could really find oneself. One could really be one's full self. And you could literally see it in his presence.
I think that, he was acutely aware of the excesses of individualism. Mm. That becoming a self is a great, I think, gift that we articulate with our own voice, our experience, our vision, our desires. But at the expense of community, well, that's what happens, I think, in some contexts around the world. The one that I come from in particular exaggerates the role of the individual as if the community really isn't of any value. There's no room for a sense of a common good anymore. And I think it's in that kind of context that we see the rise of competition, of fear, of all kinds of forms of aggression. And I think what Francis was clear about is that we have to figure out how to have an individual experience, but in a community, with a community. And again, it's a movement in a sense beyond the hyper individuation, which we're so fixated on. By contrast, for collectivist cultures that start really with the community, you know, there needs to also be room for people to have that individuation experience. So to be, in a sense, in tune with a world where you have a variety of cultures on that spectrum, all trying to make their way together, right? It's, wow, it's a lot of complexity.
It's huge complexity, and even I just told you before we started this, I'm flying to China on Sunday to run a group relations conference, directed group relations conference. And I last went to China almost in the 1990s, and Tiananmen Square was full of bicycles then, and people were flying kites in Tiananmen Square. Well, I'm going to go there now, and there's going to be skyscrapers and electric cars and high-speed trains. The pace of transformation across the world, wherever we look, is ever increasing. And to find place anchor points in our lives where we can find silence, where we can find companionship, where we can find ourselves, where we can find each other, are increasingly important. And I think the church does provide those spaces.
Yeah, you know, I think Francis was remarkable in that he had, without a kind of a very, let's say, technical theological language, he had a way of articulating a vision for what it is to be a human person in the world today, and acknowledging how hard the experience is, but also how potentially joyful it is when we do see each other as brothers and sisters. So his encyclical Fratelli Tutti, which is also a reference back to Francis of Assisi, he had from Francis of Assisi the sense that as human beings, you know, we are both these breathing clumps of soil, right, formed of the earth, but also with this inalienable human dignity, which is beautiful and where God dwells, right? So this paradox. And if we could recognize this in one another, how could we ever mistreat each other? How could we ever treat one another as we are right now in Gaza or Ukraine or South Sudan? How could we ever, you know, actually exercise our will in a way that is so domineering culturally? You know, one race against the next. If you've been, in a sense, converted to this vision of what it is to be a person in this way, and then he extends it to the rest of all of life and nature, right? So, wow, amazing.
Yeah, I mean, that was the extraordinary thing in Laudato Si, the encyclical on the environment. I mean, it was astonishing to come from Pope in the church. It was very left field. We weren't expecting that, and it was just to make that link between the, how we denigrate the environment and how we denigrate each other. You know, he made that link between the poor and the environment, and you know, that we're part of this. You know, but that was a very extraordinary kind of piece of work he did. Which
I think the insight he had, you know, going back to Genesis, was that we have misinterpreted what it meant to be, in a sense, given dominion over the earth, that the dominion has been misinterpreted as a form of lording it over. But in fact, it was intended to be a kind of stewardship, as, you know, one who's a gardener would take really good care of one's garden. That's the kind of care that we each have been given as human beings with all the capability we have to care for, you know, the planet, our other fellow species in the world, and then to align all of our systems, political, economic, social systems, in a way that are in a kind of harmony with that life, yeah. Not exploiting it, not extracting from it. I agree. It's an extraordinary vision. And it's one that has yet to really capture, you know, enough traction.
Yeah, no, I think like many visionaries or prophets, he's ahead of his time. And I think we will catch up with it. I think for me, Pope Francis' legacy, we are just starting to understand what he did in many different forms. David, we're coming to an end of the podcast, and I usually ask guests to share their own view of what it means to live a good life and a good society. But I'm going to ask you to try and just think about what we can learn from Pope Francis, any essence of his life's work, of his role as a pope, what can lead us to live a good life and create a good society. And any kind of thoughts?
You know, I it's not an easy question, but I really appreciate it, because it would be easy to talk and talk, but I think it really comes back to encounter, that every encounter we have is potentially a precious experience of the kingdom of God opening right up in that moment. That when we allow ourselves to really encounter another without our ego taking the lead, and we bring ourselves with a certain humility and vulnerability and a desire, right, to really connect, and we bring an open mind and an open heart and an open will, that encounter becomes a place of tremendous possibility, and a possibility that is incredibly fulfilling, mm-hmm. for our own needs, for relationship and belonging and intimacy, but also for some kind of fruitfulness in the world, for creativity, for imagination of a more just and a more sustainable earth, for a way of, within even the context of a single encounter between two people or three or five, a way in which we can model a kind of community experience that people generally long for and dream of. I believe that if I was to say one thing about Francis, that it was this sense that we can have the kind of encounters that Jesus had with his disciples and with the people he met on the way. And that's a life-changing kind of experience.
Beautifully said, David. Thank you so much. Keep up the good work. Prayers to you and your team. And I look forward to seeing you in Rome.
Thanks, my friend. I look forward to it too.